Cassette 9, Side 2. Completing the melting of the North Sea ice was the other obvious abatement strategy most often mentioned at the conference. Until it was all liquid, the albedo of the ice was bouncing a lot of energy back into space, and a truly lively water cycle was somewhat capped off. If they could get a liquid ocean, or, given how far north it was, a summer liquid ocean, then any ice age would be done for, and terraformation essentially complete. They would have robust currents, waves, evaporation, clouds, precipitation, melting, streams, rivers, deltas, the full hydrological cycle. This was a primary goal, and so there was a variety of methods being proposed to speed the melting of the ice. Feeding nuclear power plant exhaust heat into the ocean, scattering black algae on the ice, deploying microwave and ultrasound transmitters as heaters, even sailing big icebreakers through the shallow pack to aid the breakup. Of course, the increased greenhouse gases would help here as well. The ocean's surface ice would melt on its own, after all, as soon as the air stayed regularly above 273 Kelvin. But as the conference proceeded, more and more problems with the greenhouse gas plan were being pointed out. It entailed another huge industrial effort, almost the equal of the Metanat monster projects, like the nitrogen shipments from Titan or the Soleta itself. And it wasn't a one-time thing. The gases were constantly destroyed by UV radiation in the upper atmosphere, so they had to overproduce to reach the desired levels, and then continue producing for as long as they wanted the gases up there. Thus, mining the raw materials and constructing the factories to turn those materials into the desired gases were enormous projects, and necessarily a largely robotic effort with self-guided and replicating miners, self-building and regulating factories, upper atmosphere sampler drones, an entire machine enterprise. The technical challenge of this wasn't the issue. As Nadia pointed out to her friends at the conference, Martian technology had been highly robotic from the very beginning. In this case, thousands of small robotic cars would wander Mars on their own, looking for good deposits of carbon, sulfur, or fluorite, migrating from source to source like the old Arab mining caravans on the Great Escarpment. Then, when new feedstocks were found in high concentrations, the robots could settle down and construct little processing plants out of clay, iron, magnesium, and trace metals, providing the parts that couldn't be constructed on site, and then assembling the whole. Fleets of automated diggers and carts would be manufactured to haul the processed material into centralized factories, where the material would be gasified and released from tall, mobile stacks. It wasn't that different from the earlier mining for atmospheric gases, just a larger effort. But the most obvious deposits had already been mined, as people were now pointing out, and surface mining couldn't be done the way it used to be. There were plants growing almost everywhere now, and in many places a kind of desert pavement was developing on the surface as a result of hydration, bacterial action, and chemical reactions in the clays. This crust helped greatly to cut down on dust storms, which were still a constant problem. So ripping it up to get to underlying deposits of feedstock materials was no longer acceptable, either ecologically or politically. Red members of the legislature were calling for a ban on just this kind of robotic surface mining, and for good reasons, even in terraforming terms. It was hard, Nadia thought one night as she shut down her screen, to be faced with all the competing effects of their actions. The environmental issues were so tightly intertwined that it was hard to tease them out and decide what to do. And it was also hard to stay constrained by their own rules. Individual organizations could no longer act unilaterally because so many of their actions had global ramifications. Thus, the necessity for environmental regulation and for the Global Environmental Court, already faced with a caseload running out of control. Eventually, it would have to rule on any plans coming out of this conference as well. The days of unconstrained terraforming were gone. And as a member of the Executive Council, Nadia was restricted to saying that she thought increased greenhouse gases were a good idea. Other than that, she had to stay out, or appear to be impinging on the environmental court's territory, which Eryshka was defending very vigorously. So Nadia spent time visiting on screen with a group designing new robot miners that would minimally disrupt the surface, or talking to a group working on dust fixatives that might be sprayed or grown over the surface. Thin, fast pavements, as they called them. But they were proving to be a knotty problem. And that was the extent of Nadia's participation in the Sabashii conference that she herself had initiated. And since all its technical problems were enmeshed in political considerations anyway, it might have been said that she hadn't missed it at all. Not a bit of real work had been done there by her or anyone else. Meanwhile, back in Sheffield, the council was facing any number of problems of its own. Unforeseen difficulties in instituting the eco economy. Complaints that the GEC was overstepping its authority. Complaints about the new police and the criminal justice system. Unruly and stupid behavior in both houses of the legislature. Red and other types of resistance in the outback, and so on. The issues were endless and spanned the gamut from the profoundly important to the incredibly petty. Until Nadia began to lose all sense of where on that continuum any individual problem lay. For instance, she spent a good deal of her time involved in the council's own internal struggles, which she considered trivial but couldn't avoid. Most of these struggles involved resisting Jackie's efforts to put together a majority that would vote with Jackie every time so that Jackie could use the council as a rubber stamp for the Free Mars Party line, or, in other words, for Jackie herself. This meant getting to know the rest of the counselors better and figuring out how to work with them. Zake was an old acquaintance. Nadia liked him, and he was a power among the Arabs, their current representative to the general culture, having defeated Antar for that position. Gracious, smart, kind, he was in agreement with Nadia on many issues, including the core ones, and this made it an easy relationship, even a growing friendship. Ariadne was one of the goddesses of the Dorsabrevian matriarchy, and acted the part to a T. Imperious and rigid in her principles, she was an ideologue, probably the only thing that kept her from being a serious challenge to Jackie's prominence among the natives. Marion was the Red Counselor, an ideologue also, but much changed from her early radical days, although still a long-winded arguer, not easily beaten. Peter, Anne's little boy, had grown up to be a power in several different parts of Martian society, including the space crew at Da Vinci, the Green Underground, the cable crowd, and to an extent, because of Anne, the more moderate Reds. This versatility was part of his nature, and Nadia had a hard time getting a fix on him. He was private, like his parents, and seemed wary of Nadia and the rest of the First Hundred. He wanted a distance from them. He was Nisei through and through. Mihail Yangel was one of the earliest Issei to follow the First Hundred to Mars, and had worked with Arkady from very early on. He had helped to start the revolt of 2061, and Nadia's impression was that he had been one of the most extreme Reds at that time, which fact sometimes made her angry at him still, which was silly and impeded her ability to talk to him. But there it was, despite the fact that he too was much changed, a Bogdanovist willing to compromise. His presence on the council was a surprise to Nadia, a gesture toward Arkady, one might say, which she found touching. And then there was Jackie, very possibly the most popular and powerful politician on Mars, at least until Nergal got back. And so Nadia dealt with these six every day, learning their ways as they made their way through item after item on their daily agendas. From the important to the trivial, the abstract to the personal, everything seemed to Nadia part of a fabric where everything connected to everything. Not only was the council not part-time work, it ate up the entirety of every waking day. It consumed her life. And yet at this point, she had only gotten through 2 months of a 3M-year term. Art could see that it was getting to her, and he did what he could to help. He came up to her apartment every morning with breakfast like room service. Often he had cooked it himself, and always it was good. As he came in, platter held aloft, he called up jazz on her AI to serve as the soundtrack of their morning together, not just Nadia's beloved Lewis, though he sought out odd recordings by Satch to amuse her, things like Give Peace a Chance or Stardust Memories, but also later styles of jazz that she had never liked before because they were so frenetic. But that seemed to be the tempo of these days. Whatever the reason, Charlie Parker now skittered and zoomed around most impressively, she thought, and Charles Mingus made his big band sound like Duke Ellington's on Pandorf, which was just what Ellington and all the rest of swing needed, in her opinion. Very funny, lovely music. And best of all, on many mornings, Art called up Clifford Brown, a discovery Art had made during his investigations on her behalf, one he was very proud of and advocated constantly to her as the logical successor to Armstrong, a vibrant trumpet sound, joyous and positive and melodic like Satch, and also brilliantly fast and clever and difficult, like Parker, only happy. It was the perfect soundtrack for these wild times, driving and intense, but as positive as one could be. So Art would bring in breakfast singing All of Me in a pretty good voice, and with Satchmo's basic insight that American song lyrics could only be treated as silly jokes. All of me, why not take all of me? Can't you see, I'm no good without you? And call up some music and sit with his back to the window. And the mornings were fun. But no matter how well the days began, the council was eating her life. Nadia got more and more sick of it. The bickering, negotiating, compromising, conciliating, the dealing with people minute after minute. She was beginning to hate it. Art saw this, of course, and began to look worried. And one day after work, he brought over Ursula and Vlad. The four of them had dinner together in her apartment, Art cooking. Nadia enjoyed her old friend's company. They were in town on business, but getting them over for dinner there had been Art's idea and a good one. He was a sweet man, Nadia thought as she watched him moving about the kitchen. Canny diplomat as guileless simpleton, or vice versa. Like a benign Frank. Or a mix of Frank's skill and Arcady's happiness. She laughed at herself, always thinking of people in terms of the first 100, as if everyone was somehow a recombination of the traits of that original family. It was a bad habit of hers. Vlad and Art were talking about Anne. Sachs had apparently called Vlad from the shuttle rocket on its return to Mars, shaken by a conversation with Anne. He was wondering if Vlad and Ursula would consider offering Anne the same brain plasticity treatment that they had given him after his stroke. Anne would never do it, Ursula said. I'm glad she won't, Vlad said. That would be too much. Her brain wasn't injured. We don't know what that treatment would do in a healthy brain, and you should only undertake what you can understand unless you are desperate.
Maybe Anne is desperate, Nadia said.
No, Sachs is desperate, Vlad smiled briefly. He wants a different Anne before he gets back. Ursula said to him,
You didn't want Sachs to try that treatment either.
It's true. I wouldn't have done it to myself, but Sachs is a bold man, an impulsive man.
Now Vlad looked at Nadia.
We should stick to things like your finger, Nadia. Now that we can fix.
Surprised, Nadia said, What's wrong with it?
They laughed at her.
The one that's missing, Ursula said. We could grow it back if you wanted.
Kah! Nadia exclaimed.
She sat back, looked at her thin left hand, the stump of the missing little finger.
Well, I don't need it, really.
They laughed again.
You could have fooled us, Ursula said. You're always complaining about it when you're working.
I am.
They all nodded. It'll help your swimming, Ursula said.
I don't swim much anymore.
Maybe you stopped because of your hand.
Nadia stared at it again.
Kah! I don't know what to say.
Are you sure it will work? It might grow into an entire other hand, Hart suggested. Then into another Nadia. You'll be a Siamese twin. Nadia pushed him sideways in his chair. Ursula was shaking her head. No, no, we've done it for some other amputees already, and a great number of experimental animals. Hands, arms, legs. We learned it from frogs. Quite wonderful, really. The cells differentiate just like the first time the finger grew. A very literal demonstration of emergence theory, Vlad said with a small smile. Nadia saw by that smile that he had been instrumental in designing the procedure. It works? She asked him directly. It works. We make what is in effect a new finger bud over your stump. It's a combination of embryonic stem cells with some cells from the base of your other little finger. The combination functions as the equivalent of the homeobox genes you had when you were a fetus. So you've got the developmental determiners there to make the new stem cells differentiate properly. Then you ultrasonically inject a weekly dose of fibroblast growth factor, plus a few cells from the knuckle and the nail at the appropriate times, and it works. As he explained, Nadia felt a little glow of interest spread through her. A whole person. Art was watching her with his friendly curiosity. Well, sure, she said at last. Why not? So in the following week, they took some biopsies from her remaining little finger and gave her some ultrasonic shots in the stump of the missing finger and in her arm and gave her some pills. And that was it. After that, it was only a matter of weekly shots and waiting. Then she forgot about it because Charlotte called with a problem. Cairo was ignoring a GEC order concerning water pumping. You'd better come check it out in person. I think the Kyrenes are testing the court for a faction of Free Mars that wants to challenge the global government. Jackie, Nadia said. I think so. Cairo stood on its plateau edge, overlooking the northwesternmost U Valley of Noctis Labyrinthus. Nadia walked out of the train station with Art onto a plaza flanked by tall palm trees. She glared at the scene. Some of the worst moments of her life had occurred in this city during the assault on it in 2061. Sasha had been killed, among others, and Nadia had blown up Phobos, she herself, and all just a few days after finding Arkady's burned remains. She had never returned. She hated this town. Now she saw that it had been damaged again in the recent unrest. Parts of the tent had been blown, and the physical plant heavily damaged. It was being rebuilt, and new tent segments were being tacked onto the old town, extending west and east far along the plateau's edge. It looked like a boom town, which Nadia found peculiar, given its altitude, 10 kilometers above the datum. They would never be able to take down the tents or go outside without walkers on, and so Nadia had assumed it would therefore go into decline, but it lay at the intersection of the Equatorial Piste and the Tharsis Piste running north and south, the last place one could cross the equator between here and the Chaoses, a full quarter of the planet away. So unless a Transmarineris bridge were built somewhere, Cairo would always be at a strategic crossroads. And crossroads or not, they wanted more water. The Compton Aquifer, underlying Lower Noctis and Upper Marineris, had been breached in 61, and its water had poured down the entire length of the Marineris Canyons. This was the flood that had almost killed Nadia and her companions during the flight down the canyons after Cairo was taken. Most of the flood water had either frozen in the canyons, creating a long, irregular glacier, or had pooled and frozen in the Chaoses at the bottom of Marineris. And some water had, of course, remained in the aquifer. In the years since, the water in the aquifer had been pumped out for use in cities all over East Tharsis, and the Marineris Glacier had slowly dropped down canyon, receding at its upper end where there was no source to replenish it, leaving behind only devastated land and a string of very shallow ice lakes. Cairo was therefore running out of a ready supply of water. Its hydrology office had responded by laying a pipeline to the Northern Sea's big southern arm in the Crisi Depression and pumping water up to Cairo. So far, no problem. Every tent town got its water from somewhere. But the Cairenes had lately started pouring water into a reservoir in the Noctis Canyon under them and letting a stream out from this reservoir to run down into Ayas Chasma, where eventually it pooled behind the upper end of the Marineris Glacier or ran by it. Essentially, they had created a new river running right down the big canyon system, far away from their town. And now they were establishing a number of riverside settlements and farming communities downstream from the city. A red legal group had gone to the Global Environmental Court to challenge this action, asserting that Valles Marineris had legal consideration as a natural wonder, being the largest canyon in the solar system. If left alone, the breakout glacier would eventually have slid down into the chaos, leaving the canyons again open-floored. This was what they thought should happen, and the GEC had agreed with them and issued an order, Charlotte called this a gecko, against Cairo, requiring them to halt the release of water out of the town reservoir. Cairo had refused to desist, claiming that the global government had no jurisdiction over what they called vital town life support issues. Meanwhile, building new downstream settlements as fast as they could. Clearly, it was a provocation, a challenge to the new system. "This is a test," Art muttered as they walked across the plaza. "This is only a test." If this were a true constitutional crisis, you would hear a beep all over the planet. A test. Exactly the kind of thing for which Nadia had lost all patience. So she crossed the city in a foul mood. No doubt it didn't help that the awful days of 61 were called back so vividly to mind by the plaza, the boulevards, the city wall at the canyon rim, all just as they had been back then. They said one's memory was weakest from one's middle years, but she would have lost those memories happily if she could have. Fear and rage, however, seemed to function as some kind of nightmare fixative, for it was all still there. Frank tapping madly away at his monitors, Sasha eating pizza, Maya shouting angrily at something or other, the fraught hours of waiting to see if they would be passed over by the falling pieces of Phobos, seeing Sasha's body bloody at the ears, clicking over the transmitter that had brought Phobos down. Thus, it was very hard to keep her irritation in check as she went into the first meeting with the Cairenes and found Jackie there among them, supporting their position. Jackie was pregnant now as well, and had been for some time. She was flushed, glossy, beautiful. No one knew who the father was. It was something she was doing on her own. A Dorsa Brevia tradition by way of Hiroko, and just one more irritant to Nadia. The meeting took place in a building next to the city wall, overlooking the U-shaped canyon below called Nihilus Noctis. The water in dispute was actually visible down canyon, a broad, ice-sheeted reservoir stopped by a dam not visible from up here, stopped just before the Illyrian Gate and the new chaos of the Compton Break. Charlotte stood with her back to the window, asking the Cairene officials just the questions Nadia would have asked, but without the slightest trace of Nadia's annoyance. "You will always be in a tent. Opportunities for growth will be limited. Why flood Marineris when you won't benefit from it?" No one seemed to care to answer this. Finally, Jackie said, "The people living down there will benefit, and they're part of Greater Cairo. Water in any form is a resource at these altitudes." "Water running freely down Marineris is no resource at all," Charlotte said. The Cairenes argued for the utility of water in Marineris. There were also representatives of the downstream settlers, many of them Egyptians, claiming that they had been in Marineris for generations, that it was their right to live there, that it was the best farming land on Mars, that they would fight before they would leave, and so on. Sometimes the Cairenes and Jackie seemed to be defending these neighbors, at other times their own right to use Marineris as a reservoir. Mostly, they seemed to be defending their right to do whatever they wanted. Slowly, Nadia got angrier and angrier. "The court made its judgment," she said. "We're not here to argue it again. We're here to see it enacted." And she left the meeting before she said anything inexcusable. That night she sat with Charlotte and Art, so irritated that she couldn't focus on a delicious Ethiopian meal in the train station restaurant. "What do they want?" she asked Charlotte. Charlotte shrugged, mouth full. After swallowing, "Have you been noticing that being president of Mars isn't a particularly powerful position?" "Hell yes, it would be hard to miss." "Yes, well, the whole executive council is the same, of course. It's looking like the real power in this government is in the environmental court. Eriska was put in charge there as part of the grand gesture, and she's done a lot to legitimate moderate redness by staking out a middle ground. It allows for a lot of development under the 6K limit, but above that, they're very strict. That's all backed by the Constitution, so they've been able to make everything stand. The legislature is laying off. They haven't overturned any judgments yet. So it's been an impressive first session for Eriska and that whole group of justices."
"So Jackie is jealous," Nadia said.
Charlotte shrugged. "It's possible." "More than possible," Nadia said grimly. "And then there's the matter of the council itself. Jackie may think this is something she can get three of the others to back her on, and then the council becomes that much more hers. Cairo is an arena where she might hope that Zake will vote with her because of the Arab part of town. Then only two more. And then both Mikhail and Ariadne are strong localists."
"But the council can't overturn court decisions," Nadia said. "Only the legislature, right? By legislating new laws."
"Right. But if Cairo continues to defy the court, then it would be up to the council to order the police to go down there and physically stop them. That's what the executive branch is supposed to do. If the council didn't do it, then the court would be undermined and Jackie would take effective control of the council. Two birds with one stone."
Nadia threw down her bit of spongy bread. "I'll be damned if that happens," she said. They sat in silence.
"I hate this stuff," Nadia said.
Charlotte said, "In a few years, there will be a body of practices, institutions, laws, amendments to the Constitution, all that. Things that the Constitution never addressed, which translated into action. Like the proper role of political parties. Right now, we're in the process of working all these things out."
"Maybe so, but I still hate it.
Think of it as meta-architecture. Building the culture that allows architecture to exist. Then it'll be less frustrating for you."
Nadia snorted.
"This one should be a clear case," Charlotte said. "The judgment has been made. They only have to abide by it."
"What if they don't?"
"Time for the police."
"Civil war, in other words.
They won't push it that far. They signed the Constitution just like everyone else, and if everyone else is abiding by it, then they'll become outlaws like the Red Écouteurs. I don't think they'll go that far. They're just testing the limits."
She didn't seem annoyed by this. That was the way people were, her expression seemed to say. She didn't blame anyone. She wasn't frustrated. A very calm woman, this Charlotte. Relaxed, confident, capable. With her coordinating it, the Executive Council's work had so far been well organized, if not easy. If that competence was what growing up in a matriarchy like Dorsa Brevia did for you, Nadia thought, then more power to them. She couldn't help but compare Charlotte to Maya, with all Maya's mood shifts, her angst and self-dramatization. While it was probably an individual thing in any culture, but it was going to be interesting to have more Dorsa Brevia women around to take on these jobs. At the next morning's meeting, Nadia stood and said, "An order against dumping water in Marineris has been issued already. If you persist in the dumping, the new police powers of the global community will be exerted. I don't think anyone wants that."
"I don't think you can speak for the Executive Council," Jackie said.
"I can," Nadia said shortly.
"No, you can't," Jackie said. "You're only one of seven, and this isn't a council matter anyway."
"We'll see about that," Nadia said. The meeting dragged on. The Kyrenes were stonewalling. The more Nadia understood what they were doing, the less she liked it. Their leaders were important in Free Mars, and even if this challenge failed, it might result in concessions to Free Mars in other areas, so the party would have gained more power. Charlotte agreed that this could be their ultimate motive. The cynicism of this disgusted Nadia, and she found it very hard to be civil to Jackie when Jackie spoke to her, with her easy cheerfulness, the pregnant queen cruising around among her minions like a battleship among rowboats. "Aunt Nadia, so sorry you felt you needed to take time for such a thing as this." That night, Nadia said to Charlotte, "I want a ruling where Free Mars gets nothing at all out of this." Charlotte laughed briefly. "Been talking to Jackie, have you?" "Yes." "Why is she so popular? I don't understand it, but she is." "She's nice to a lot of people. She thinks she's nice to everyone." "She reminds me of Phyllis," Nadia said. "The first 100 again." "Maybe not. Anyway, isn't there some sort of penalty we can invoke against frivolous suits and challenges?" "Court costs in some cases. See if you can lay that on her, then. First, let's see if we can win." The meetings went on for another week. Nadia left the talking to Charlotte and Art. She spent the meetings looking out the windows at the canyon below and in rubbing the stump of her finger, which now had a noticeable new bump on it. So strange. Despite paying close attention, she couldn't recall when the bump had first appeared. It was warm and pink, a delicate pink, like a child's lips. There seemed to be a bone in the middle of it. She was afraid to squeeze it very hard. Surely lobsters didn't pinch their returning limbs. All that cell proliferation was disturbing, like a cancer, only controlled, directed, the miracle of DNA's instructional abilities made manifest. Life itself, flourishing in all its emergent complexity. And a little finger was nothing compared to an eye or an embryo. It was a strange business. With that going on, the political meetings looked really dreadful. Nadia walked out of one having heard almost none of it, though she was sure nothing significant had happened, and she went for a long walk out to an overlook bulging out of the western end of the tent wall. She called Sax. The four travelers were getting closer to Mars. Transmission delays were down to a few minutes. Nergal appeared to be healthy again. He was in good spirits. Michelle actually looked more drained than Nergal. It seemed that the visit to Earth had been hard on him. Nadia held up her finger to the screen to cheer him up, and it worked. "A pinky, don't they call it that?"
"I guess so."
"You don't seem to believe it's going to work."
"No, I guess I don't."
"We're in a transitional period, I think," Michelle said. "At our age, we can't really believe that we're still alive, so we act as if it will end at any minute."
"Which it could."
Thinking of Simon, or Tatiana Durova, or Arkady. "Of course, but then again it might go on for decades more, or even centuries. After a while we'll have to start believing in it." He sounded like he was trying to convince himself as much as her. "You'll look at your whole hand and then you'll believe it, and that will be very interesting." Nadia wiggled the pink nub at the end of her hand. No fingerprint yet in the fresh, translucent skin. No doubt when it came, it would be the same fingerprint as the one on the other little finger. Very strange. Art came back from one meeting looking concerned. "I've been asking around about this," he said, "trying to figure out why they're doing it. I put some Praxis operatives on the case down in the canyon and back on Earth, and inside the Free Mars leadership." Spies, Nadia thought. Now we have spies. "Appears that they're making private arrangements with Terran governments concerning immigration. Building settlements and giving places to people from Egypt, definitely, and probably China, too. It's got to be a quid pro quo, but we don't know what they're getting in return from these countries. Money, possibly." Nadia growled. In the next couple of days, she met on screen or in person with all the other members of the Executive Council. Marion was, of course, against pumping any more water into Marinaris, and so Nadia needed only two more votes. but Mikhail and Ariadne and Peter were unwilling to bring the police to bear if it could be avoided in any other way, and Nadia suspected they weren't much happier than Jackie at the relative weakness of the council. They seemed willing to make concessions to avoid an awkward enforcement of a court judgment they weren't adamantly behind. Zeke clearly wanted to vote against Jackie, but felt constrained by the Arab constituency in Cairo and the eyes of the Arab community on him. Control of land and water were both important to them. But the Bedouin were nomadic, and besides, Zeke was a strong supporter of the constitution. Nadia thought he would support her. That left one more to be convinced. The relationship with Mikhail had never improved. It was as if he wanted to be closer to Arkady's memory than she was. Peter, she didn't feel she understood. Ariadne, she didn't like, but in a way that made it easier. And Ariadne had come to Cairo as well. So Nadia decided to work on her first. Ariadne was as committed to the constitution as most of the Dorsabrevians, but they were localists as well, and were no doubt thinking about keeping some independence of their own from the global government. And they, too, were far from any water supply. So Ariadne had been wavering. Look, Nadia said to her in a little room across the plaza from the city offices, you've got to forget about Dorsabrevia and think about Mars. I am, of course. She was irritated that this meeting was taking place. She would rather have dismissed Nadia out of hand. The merits of the case weren't what mattered to her. It was just a matter of precedence, of not having to listen to any Issei. It was power politics and hierarchy to these people now. They had forgotten the real issues involved. And in this damned city... Suddenly Nadia lost her patience, and she almost shouted, You're not thinking at all. This is the first challenge to the Constitution, and you're looking around for what you can get out of it. I won't have it. She waved a finger under Ariadne's surprised face. If you don't vote to enforce the court ruling, then the next time something you really want comes up for a council vote, you'll see reprisals from me. Do you understand? Ariadne's eyes were like billboards, first shocked, then a moment of pure fear, then anger. She said, I never said I wasn't going to vote for enforcement. What are you going ballistic for? Nadia returned to a more ordinary argument mode, although still hard and tense and unrelenting. Finally, Ariadne threw up her hands. It's what most of the Dorsabrevia Council wants to do. I was going to vote for it anyway. You don't have to be so frantic about it. And she hurried out of the room, very upset. First, Nadia felt a surge of triumph, but that look of fear in the young woman's eyes, it stuck with her until she began to feel slightly sick to her stomach. She remembered Coyote on Pavonis saying, Power corrupts. That was the sick feeling. That first hit of power used or misused. Much later that night, she was still sick with repulsion, and almost weeping, she told Art about the confrontation. That sounds bad, he said gravely. That sounds like a mistake. You still have to deal with her. When that's the case, you have to just tweak people. I know, I know. God, I hate this, she said. I want to get away. I want to do something real. He nodded heavily, patted her shoulder. Before the next meeting, Nadia went over to Jackie and told her quietly that she had the council votes to put police down at the dam to stop any further release of water. Then in the meeting itself, she reminded everyone in an offhand remark that Nergal would be back among them very soon, along with Maya and Sax and Michelle. This caused several of the Free Mars group on hand to look thoughtful, though Jackie, of course, showed no reaction. As they nattered on after that, Nadia rubbed her finger, distracted, still upset with herself about the meeting with Ariadne. The next day, the Kyrenes agreed to accept the judgment of the Global Environmental Court. They would cease releasing water from their reservoir, and the settlements down canyon would have to exist on piped water, which would certainly pinch their growth. Good, Nadia said, still bitter. All that just to obey the law. They're going to appeal, Hart pointed out.
I don't care. They're done for. And even if they aren't, they've submitted to the process. Hell, they can win for all I care. It's the process that counts, so we win no matter what.
Art smiled to hear this. A step in her political education, no doubt. A step Art and Charlotte seemed to have taken long ago. What mattered to them wasn't the result of any single disagreement, but the successful use of the process. If Free Mars represented the majority now, and apparently it did, as it had the allegiance of almost all the natives, young fools that they were, then submitting to the Constitution meant that they couldn't simply push around minority groups by force of numbers. So when Free Mars won something, it would have to be on the merits of the case, judged by the full array of court justices who came from all factions. That was quite satisfying, actually, like seeing a wall made of delicate materials bear more weight than it looked like it could because of a cleverly built framework. But she had used threats to shore up one beam, and so the whole thing left a bad taste in her mouth. I want to do something real.
Like plumbing?
She nodded, not even close to a smile. Yes, hydrology.
Can I come along?
Be a plumber's helper? He laughed.
I've done it before.
This ends side two of cassette 9 of Blue Mars. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette 10.